Hi, podcast listeners. This is Doug Fabrizio. For the past 2 months, the Radio West Book Club has been reading Marilynne Robinson's Pulitzer Prize winner, Gilead. It's an epistolary novel. It's a collection of letters from the Reverend John Ames to his young son about his life as a preacher in the small town of Gilead, Iowa. Robinson taught for a number of years at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She's the author of countless essays, 5 novels, 4 of which, by the way, focus on characters she first introduced in Gilead. The book critic James Wood wrote that Robinson's words have a spiritual force that's very rare in contemporary fiction. Spirituality, faith, and doubt are themes that Robinson returns to again and again in her work. We met recently as a group to talk about Gilead. Our guest was Dr. George Handley. He's a professor of humanities at Brigham Young University. Christy Miners, our executive producer, led the discussion, and Dr. Handley went first.
She was born in what's called Sandpoint, Idaho, which is a couple hours north of Moscow. If you know your Idaho geography, it's very far north. It's extraordinarily remote. And she has a PhD in English. So she was trained as a scholar, but wrote a novel in the early 80s called Housekeeping. And that novel, if you liked Gilead, I would strongly recommend it. It's probably the most beautiful novel I've ever read. It's much more tragic and sad than Gilead, but it has just a beauty that's, and it's also a book to read slowly and really savor. In fact, she kind of wrote it almost as an exercise in poetry and theology, and then it kind of assumed a plot as she went along. But that novel takes place in Sandpoint, and she gives it a fictional name. And the landscape is just so alive in that book. It is obviously in Gilead as well, and that's just one of her gifts, is this sort of ability to make the land really come alive. And then she ends up being a professor of creative writing at Iowa, at the Iowa Workshop, and she had only published that one novel, but then ended up writing some nonfiction and apparently never really cared about whether or not she wrote another novel. I mean, from what she told me, she wasn't bothered by, you know, needing to follow up on such a successful first novel. It won a few awards. It got a lot of attention. It kind of almost created a little bit of a kind of a cult following. I mean, just, you know, people in the know just said, whoever could write a novel like this must be really, really good and probably should write a lot more. And she just never pressured herself, never hurried herself to get another novel. And of course didn't for over 20 years. But in the course of living in Iowa, she's a real historian. I mean, she loves reading history and knowing history of a place. And she just kind of grounded herself in Iowan history as much as possible. She's also a Congregationalist by sectarian identification as a Christian. she's always been kind of actively involved teaching Sunday school and, you know, but then sort of getting very serious about writing theology, specifically about John Calvin. What she told me was that Gilead kind of came about almost by accident. She was meeting her son, and she's, by the way, I think she has 2 children, maybe 3. She's raised them by herself for a long time. She's very private. I never gotten anything out of her about her family life, but she was going to meet one of her sons for Christmas, I think in Rhode Island or something. And she was in a hotel waiting for him to arrive, and he got delayed several days because of a major snowstorm. And she says that the voice of John Ames just kind of came to her. She just could hear his talking, you know, like a almost like a vision experience. And so she started writing down what she was hearing. And one thing that's really interesting about her writing style or her writing method is that she doesn't revise. What she does is she will not move on to the next paragraph until she's confident And I don't know that she's done this with everything she's written, but this is what she told me actually after her third novel. So I guess this is pretty much the way she does it. But she said that she doesn't like moving on to the next paragraph until she's confident that that paragraph is done. And then she sort of allows what she's written to sort of move the plot forward, if you can imagine that. It's kind of mind-boggling to me because the novel, actually all of her novels, or at least all the Iowa ones, have much more to the plot than is immediately visible, right? And you sort of move into the books and it gets more and more complicated. And that's kind of astounding to me. I've never heard any writer describe their writing method that way. And I even teased her. I said, you teach writing, and that seems like the most unhelpful like methodology to pass on to your students. Like, just sit in a hotel until somebody starts talking and then dictate it and don't go back and revise it. So she's, you know, and then she, as you probably all know, she's written, and she just published her fourth book that is about the same characters that all are in Gilead. I've just gotten it in the mail, so I haven't actually read it yet, but they're all, this is also just a very unusual literary strategy that's almost unheard of. I mean, certainly people have written trilogies and so on. She doesn't even, she insists there's not a real proper term for what these novels are in relationship to each other, but they're all the same characters, but different perspectives. I mean, they're, you know, Lila, her third of the series, is of course all about Ames's wife, and it's her whole background, like everything that you don't know about her before she shows up and becomes a convert. And so you end up seeing the same characters that you've come to know and love, but from a completely different angle. And it's just fascinating how it illuminates the complexity of people in a way that a single novel just can't quite do, no matter how hard novelists try to give you sort of a sense of the multiple perspectives of human experience. I think she's achieved something with multiple novels in the same place, same setting, same characters that almost nobody's ever really accomplished. And meanwhile, she's also this extraordinary theologian and essayist. So she's written a number of books of essays, and they're all just really, really challenging, really insightful. You know, she moralizes about the state of affairs in our country, and writes about the, you know, the Bible, or writes about, she has essays about science and the status of science in our society now, and so on. Anyway, I can say more about that if you want, but.
To your point about her continually mining the very few, I mean, this isn't a novel that's packed full of characters. You know, she doesn't have a huge body of characters that she's pulling from, and yet that she continues to write about them. And I think you're right in that there is more to the plot of Gilead than meets the eye. You know, when you first start reading, it's very lyrical. It doesn't seem terribly plot driven. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about the quietness of this world that she creates. This is not a dramatic story per se. You know, this is about a small town preacher who stays in a small town, doesn't do a lot of traveling, doesn't have a lot of associations outside of his small world. And yet she gets something very rich out of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
One thing just by way of background that might be of interest is that she's very unaware of any contemporary writers. And she admits this openly. She just doesn't read anybody. So she reads a lot of 19th century literature. She loves the Transcendentalists and Melville, and she loves the Bible, and then she loves history and theology. So that's her world. And she admits openly that Gilead on its face is an incredibly boring set of characters in an incredibly boring place. But that's, as you can tell, kind of part of her point, right? That there's something, there's a real failure in our culture to perceive each other as the mysterious, miraculous beings that we are. She's extraordinarily insistent on this point in her essays and certainly in her fiction, that human beings are really marvelous creatures, and we should we should interact with one another and learn to cultivate a deeper sense of mystery and wonder about each other. And so I think that's part of it, right, is that she's kind of putting away all of the other distractions. I mean, there's certainly a lot of interesting plots going on in the story, but you can tell that the emphasis is certainly John Ames' theology is really grounded in a kind of wonder at the gift of existence. I was going to read a couple of statements she made in an interview I did with her that are kind of on this point. She says, "My theological intention is always to celebrate by exploration, in effect, a human consciousness, a human self. We are capable of awful things, but amazing at the same time, always amazing. I talk about this probably more than anyone else in the world, but it really does bother me that there's a persistence and pressure in the culture now to undervalue human beings, human minds, and so on. And that is against my religion." And as she said that, she laughed, by the way. She just is sort of has this buoyant laugh when she talks. She also says, "One of the things that I take to be true is that our interior lives are really between ourselves and God. Someone of whom it might be possible to conclude nothing interesting or terribly positive might have a really very beautiful perception of the world." So you can just sort of see that the inwardness of human consciousness is so miraculous to her that it's worth just, and that's what's so beautiful about picking a character who is writing in a genre that's, you know, provoking the most honest deliberations about his own conscious experience, right? He's writing in anticipation of dying as if he were already dead to his child, right? To sort of leave behind a witness of what his conscious experience was like. And so I think that's, you know, maybe one reason why I think it was a beautiful thing to have selected. Of course, I guess she didn't make a conscious decision about this. John Ames just showed up and demanded to be represented, but it seems like a perfect opportunity for someone of her mind just to be able to allow that kind of reflection to take place in the book.
Well, and one of the things that we as a group talked about a lot online was just her celebration through John Ames of the tiny little moments of life, things that we could almost pass unnoticed. I was going to read one just quote from the book. This was something that Dan made note of, and I had glossed over it, honestly. And since going back to it, it's just, I think it's a really beautiful encapsulation of how she celebrates kind of the mundane, I think is probably the word. The quote is, "Sometimes I have loved the peacefulness of an ordinary Sunday. It is like standing in a newly planted garden after a warm rain. You can feel the silent and invisible life. All it needs from you is that you take care not to trample on it." And that seems indicative of the kinds of theology and the way that she is celebrating the humanity and also just the beauty of the world, which I know we're going to get to, is her love for the environment. But one of the things that brought up is her sense of grace. This comes up in John Ames' writing over and over and over again. So what does grace mean for Marilynne Robinson?
Yeah, I think it has a lot of different meanings. Certainly it implies giftedness, right? Or she uses the word givenness of things, that there is a grace is a gift that's unearned, right? Unexpected even. The kind of spiritual work that she feels we all need to do is to sort of cultivate that sense of awareness of ourselves and of others and of the physical world that can disassociate ourselves enough from the mundane in order to, you know, transmutate the mundane into the extraordinary, into the miraculous. And that's, you know, these are these little epiphanies you see him having in the book that I think resonate with lots of readers, right? When you, and she says that when she published Gilead, all the readers in Iowa just were crazy about it because they all identified so much with her descriptions of the landscape there. And, you know, as I mentioned, I was so captivated by housekeeping that I made a sort of pilgrimage all the way to Sandpoint, Idaho, just so I could see the lake that she had written about. Even though I had never experienced that place, I felt like I had. I think we all kind of instinctively recognize that. And she's just sort of interested in sort of helping us develop the mindset that sees beauty as a sacred thing, that sees it as a gift. And that recognizes, I mean, she calls it the sacred beauty of the creation, or she says the idea of grace is on page 97 is a sort of ecstatic fire that takes things down to essentials. This is what allows the pleasure of feeling the presence of his mortal and immortal being. Existence is the essential thing and the holy thing. You know, these are experiences of grace that require imagination on our part, you know. Maybe I can explain that a little bit more. The best example she gave to me of this is sort of what opens you up to mystery and to the experience of grace. She talked about when I was interviewing her, she just gave this example of, like, if you're on a train and you see a couple talking, you know, on the aisle across from you, you are going to notice inflections in their voice or expressions on their faces that are going to communicate that something is going on, but you won't know what it is that's going on. And so you'll start building around that an imagined subtext, right, that will make sense of what you are seeing. And it's that kind of work that we do with not just the physical world, but also with other people, that sort of opens up the roundedness, the fullness, the subjectivity, and the complexity of another consciousness. I don't know. So it's the ability to receive grace is also cultivated in the imagination, if I could put it that way.
How much of this is of her own making, and how much of this is she gleaning from Calvin and some of these other theologians that she was really embedded in?
Well, I'm not a big reader in Calvin, so I can't say for sure, although she's quoted him in some of her essays to suggest that there's a line from Calvin about physical world as kind of the garment of God or something. I can't remember the phrase that she quotes, but her understanding of seeing the physical world as creation, as gift, is definitely grounded in that, but it's also from the transcendentalists. I mean, there's just such a heavy indebtedness to their ability to see so much more. I mean, there's a passage I particularly love in Moby Dick, and I know she's a huge fan of that book and teaches it or taught it for years before she retired. That's sort of a description. I think it's Pip who goes under. He's sort of halfway above the ocean. He's been tossed off the ship, and he ends up sort of going underneath for a while, and it's almost like a vision of heaven. It's like the undersea world becomes this, which is of course this, you know, immersed physical experience, but it turns into this transcendental spiritual experience. So I think she's very much indebted to her favorite writers. Emily Dickinson is probably at the top of the list in terms of a kind of spiritual sensibility and an ability to see through the physical world into something far deeper.
Well, I want us to talk in a little bit about how she views fiction, but I think before we get into some of that, let's talk about some of the particulars of Gilead. We have to address John Ames. I can't even call him senior, the grandfather John Ames, because he's such a vivid character in this book. I mean, he just, every time he appears on the page, he just takes over every scene that he's in. So talk to us a little bit about if she's mentioned much about this character, what for her perhaps he represents, what function he plays in the book. If anybody has any comments or thoughts about the grandfather John Ames, he's just so great. And there's so many great little details that show up about him.
Yeah, I actually asked her a little bit about him because I was so fascinated by the violence of his revelations and sort of the stark clarity of them. And And then John Ames has just this really beautiful and admirable sense of nuance. And yet I wondered if, of course, John Ames sort of wonders this too. It's like, is that kind of forceful visionary capacity something to be envied, or is it something to be terrified about? And I think it's a little of both, right? But she has that line in the book, I think, where he sort of decides that there's something too narrow about his grandfather's visions, and there's something instead about the world he now inhabits, where he's capable, for one, of speculation, of skepticism, at least empathy towards skepticism, even if he doesn't adopt it entirely, and secularity as sort of part of his world in a way that it wasn't part of his grandfather's world. And there's that image of sort of the burning fire, and now it's kind of embers, right? And so this is, you get a sense of this sort of existence of religion in a now mostly secularized world that maybe actually has a opportunity to be a sort of more refined way of being religious that isn't fanatical or violent. And yet, you know, of course she admires, and Ames does too, the sort of moral forcefulness of, you know, those forebears in the way that they were able to, you know, fight for abolition and so on. So it's an interesting question, you know, whether or not Ames has sort of, by virtue of that fire sort of dimming over the generations, is he less capable of being the moral force in a still racist world that his grandfather was, right? And you know, of course, he's a little slow, right? He's a little slow to kind of understand all the ramifications of what's going on and what he needs to do about it. So I do think that's an interesting and problematic character that I agree is worth exploring more.
Matt, did you have a comment?
Yeah, about the grandfather, but also about her theology as well. And I think the two are really connected. I think you sort of see in the contrast between Ames and his grandfather this kind of paradox, and that I think she does get from Calvin. Something that she cites from Calvin and also from Jonathan Edwards, who is another, you know, great Calvinist thinker, is that in a real sense, the beauty of this world comes from the fact that, as Calvin says, God is willing this world to exist as it does in every moment. Yes, there's no moment that isn't actively chosen by God. There's nothing that exists that is not actively in every moment given to us by God. And in a sense, right, that's beautiful and lovely, you know, that everything we experience is a real gift to us, but it's also, in a sense, kind of unbearable as well, you know, because that's the world that the grandfather lives in, right? He lives in a world in which he senses so powerfully God's will and God's presence, God's desire at every moment, and it's so hard for him to live in a society in which other people don't sense that as clearly and powerfully as he does. You know, so it is a paradox, but in the same way, I think that Christianity is a paradox, right? That we're both fallen beings, but also divine beings at the same time, that we're both, you know, of the children of God, but also creatures capable of evil at the same time. And it may be, I think, that the grandfather figure just is more acutely aware of that than everybody else is. And Ames is, you know, Ames is trying to find a way, I think, to kind of reconcile those visions. And as we see, I think, through his life, that's a constant struggle. It's a struggle of being alive. It's a struggle of being human. It's how do we reconcile our imperfections with our ability to understand perfection? And the grandfather couldn't reconcile that, which is why he lives a life that's entirely one of frustration.
Yeah, I think there's that's really well said. I think there's also, you know, she, in the interview I did, she said something to the effect that vision is one thing, but another thing is to articulate vision, right, or to interpret vision. And I think there's sense too that the grandfather's capable of vision, but not as circumspect, right, as John Ames becomes. But his work is no less spiritual, I think, is her point. In fact, maybe it's a broader kind of vision, right? Because he's able to see God in, you know, the sunset or in the cornfields and in the dew and in these ordinary moments. And so the whole world, now that everything's embers, it's like as if the whole world's a fire rather than just this like specific location, right? So in a certain sense, he's actually more visionary. And I think that's actually kind of related. I know you want to talk a little bit about kind of writing as prayer, but it's related to her whole understanding of what it means to write a novel, right? Because this writing of a novel is such an articulation of a sense of vision that she experiences and then wants to give language to it. And then the capacity to be able to pass that on to others is itself such a miracle to her that, you know, it feels like spiritual work to keep these embers, keep blowing on the embers, as it were.
Yeah, my favorite line about the grandfather is, how does it go? The waters never parted for him, not once. he's living in this world and constantly expecting this sort of massive miracle to transform everything and to make everyone else understand the world the way that he does. And he's incapable of communicating that.
Yeah.
You know, but Ames does become capable, I think, of communicating that vision in a way his grandfather is not able to. And there's something I think there about kind of the notion of incarnation, right? And how does God become present in our world by becoming a human like us? And the grandfather isn't able to do that. You know, he can't be like everybody else, but Ames can. And there's a way then that he's capable of then channeling the sort of spirit and the grace and all the rest of it in a way that his grandfather was not able to. And I think the fascinating thing is that he doesn't recognize it in himself. You know, he never really, I think, sees how transformative he is for other people, like Lila, for instance, or even like Jack. And I think we as readers see that, you know, but he doesn't. And then there's kind of a mystery and a beauty in that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about, I think Jack is a good one, especially since he just had a novel come out.
his own novel.
Yeah. He got his own. But what was interesting to me about Jack is, of course, we're getting this book, we're, you know, the point of view is all from John Ames, it's not from Broughton. And yet we see this relationship unfold between Jack and John Ames. So I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about Jack as a character and that relationship and why there were, I don't know if that distance between the two of them helped him see Jack a little bit more clearly than his own father.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. I mean, she certainly structures the novel around, you know, she knows this is a prodigal son story, right? This is, you know, very much influenced by that particular biblical narrative. And it's an interesting question, however, why it's not the father, but the sort of surrogate father who sees. There's a, sorry to keep drawing from language that she used in my interview, but she uses this, when we were talking about why she does all these different novels about the same character, she says, I sort of have this obsession with the peripheral. And there's something about maybe a direct biological father-son relationship that is not peripheral enough to see properly. Like, it's almost like we see more properly when we learn how to see askance or see at an angle rather than see directly, that we're kind of, and it may be just kind of the Christian notion of the mote and or beam that's in our eyes or something that we can't see properly, that allows him at this sort of surrogate level. And of course, you know, part of the story is his own difficulty in coming to terms with what it is he's actually seeing, right? Because you're the reader and John are both kind of like, okay, this guy seems like he's a threat. He seems like he's up to something. What's going on? What's pretty fascinating, if you read, I haven't read Jack yet, but if you read In Home especially, which is Gloria's point of view, I think Ames comes off quite cold because you don't have access to his interior life. And that's part of her whole point, right? Is that you can't really know somebody unless you have access to their interior life. And that's only possible because of language. But as long as someone's either inaccessible because they're dead or because they choose not to share, they don't use language to communicate their interior life, then you're kind of limited at what you can see. So I don't know if that, I suspect that that has something to do with it, right? That she's kind of in love with this idea of these adoptive relationships in the novel. Even the marriage is a sort of spiritual adoption, right? And of course, if you read Lila, then you get the whole backstory there, and you see again that these are totally different worlds that are coming together just with these very ordinary people. But there's always this gulf, right, between people. And that gulf, I think, is hardest to discern when it's, I don't know if, you know, that resonates with the rest of you, but I my own family relationships are often the most fraught precisely because they're so close, you know, and you can't get that distance to be able to sort of see them the way other people do. So it's often very helpful to have someone else tell you what's going on or someone else play a role in a family because the direct family members can't play it.
I think that's so true. I mean, that's family therapy has helped many for that very reason. What you say about peripheral is especially interesting when you think about how she's shifted her gaze just ever so slightly with each of these subsequent novels. You know, there was John Ames, that's where the focus was. And then there was a ever so slight pivot and ever so, you know, to Glory, to, you know, from on and on. I think that's particularly interesting in thinking about that. And I think this is a good segue to talk about, you know, as we've been discussing writing as a way and fiction as a way to understand and to get into the minds of people. I've read a little bit that she sees fiction as a form of spiritual practice. Can you talk about her thoughts on that? And I would love to know if other people, what your thoughts on this of reading fiction as part of a spiritual practice.
Yeah, I think she, I go back to that example I was giving you earlier, when you the couple talking on the train, when you start doing the exercise of imagining that subtext, you start essentially fictionalizing, right? You the moral imagination, and say you were actually called into action, right, in a situation with a stranger where you had to, you know, provide some assistance, or you're being asked a question and you don't know why, or being asked for help and you don't know what the problem is. We with strangers, it's sort of more obvious with strangers than it is with people who are familiar to us that there's a much bigger subtext that we can't see. And so we have to be moral in the world means that we have to have a kind of imagination. And often what we do is we sort of, this is also how we get relationships wrong. And then we make corrections, right? We imagine a subtext that actually wasn't there. My wife says something to me that sounds to me like she's not very happy with me. And then I imagine that that's the case. And it turns out that I'm totally making that up in my own head or whatever. I mean, these are the struggles of human communication, but they involve, her point is that by no means should we imagine that fiction writing is this like really unique practice that only, you know, specialized artists do. It's a human exercise that we do every single day. And not only is it that ordinary, it's also totally miraculous. I mean, it's evidence in her mind almost. I mean, it's almost like she's saying the fact that we are capable of making up fictions is evidence that God exists. I mean, I those are my words, not hers, but it's that's almost as far as she pushes it, that it's such an extraordinary thing that we do that there, and for her, and this is not unique to her, but you'll hear a lot of fiction writers talk about their characters as if they're real people. I mean, that woman is totally in love with her characters. And when I asked her, you know, why did you even bother going back to the same people? Why didn't you go on to another novel? And she was like, I couldn't let them go. They're just like so much a part of me. And not to give too much away about another novel, but Lila has this crisis of faith about whether or not the people who saved her life people who conservative Christians would see as sinners, whether or not they're going to go to heaven. And if she, and if they're not going to heaven, she's going to have a real hard problem with that. And her ability to imagine the goodness of these people and to love them is sort of their, her evidence that they will be saved. I mean, that's kind of how Robinson sees it. She says in the interview to something to the effect that you say something essential and incredibly profound about a person when you love them. And that loving is, again, not just a fact-finding experience. It's an imaginative, complementary experience or supplementary experience to what you actually know. It's also what you imagine, right? And that's how a person moves from being two-dimensional to three, or, you know, to being a more miraculous, mysterious, spiritual being in front of you, rather than this object, or rather than somebody that you could use for something, right? So moral relationships require that.
And Thea had a great question, which I think is a really appropriate one, asking, what if you don't share the author's perspective of spirituality? Is there something within her work for that audience, for those who don't share her Christian faith? What is in her writing that may still resonate?
Well, I think, I think what I'm describing, that's a great question. And she's been asked that many times. And her answer to that would be simply, well, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I can only hope that it works for people, but to the degree that you feel moved by her fictions, that's good enough, right? I mean, you don't have to follow the logic of everything she's saying, but I think it's, I'm just trying to, you know, give some articulation of what is motivating her. But I mean, I think a lot of people who consider themselves either, you know, non-religious or atheist or whatever, and don't identify with her kind of definitional spirituality, nevertheless find her writing to be deeply rewarding, right? And I think that's all that I think she hopes for.
Yeah.
It looks like Ryan is essentially saying that. I still found much there and consider it one of my favorite novels. And I think that's what she would, that's all that she would hope for.
Well, and especially as you were talking about the way she views fiction, I mean, really the heart of that is empathy, right? She's saying use fiction as a form to gain empathy for others, it goes back to the Harper Lee idea of crawling around in somebody else's shoes and walking around.
I mean, I think she's extremely defensive about the dignity of human life. And that vision of the dignity of human life for her is based in her Christianity. But she thinks Christians have done just as much damage as anybody, if not more, to that idea. She thinks Christians are the largest obstacle to the health and well-being of Christianity as a tradition. So she has no problem with other people who don't share her views, nevertheless, her religious views, nevertheless sharing her belief in the dignity of human life and in the value of individual beings and sort of the ethics and morality that surround that concept. She thinks that's all that really matters. And that's what she, I think, hopes she communicates with her fiction. So in that sense, I think she thinks of herself as doing Christian work by spreading that concept, even though it's not attached to any sort of obligatory, you know, set of doctrines or something.
Yeah. One thing I think that might really surprise this group, and I just dipped my toe into it. She is, as you talked about at the beginning, she's very passionate about landscape and land, and writes about it very beautifully in her work. But she takes issue with the environmentalist movement. You want to talk a little bit about her love of land, but also some of the problems she has with the term environmentalism?
Well, a lot of it's shaped by a very negative experience she had writing a book called Mother Country, which is a very devastating critique of British culture and its relationship to nuclear waste, and essentially diagnoses the British psyche as having sort of adopted this mentality that we are an environmental culture. And because we tell ourselves that we're an environmental culture, this has actually sort of shielded us from being able to admit that things are far worse than we think they are. And so, and she was actually, Greenpeace actually banned her book in England because she was very critical of them and covering up what she saw as this scandalous record of nuclear waste that was not getting, was not properly registered in the British mind. So she's actually quite critical of sort of the profiteering and the institutionalization of environmentalism. She is nevertheless, you know, deeply concerned about climate change and believes in evolution and reads rigorously and consistently. She reads science. I mean, she's very scientifically literate. So she's not like anti-science or anti-environmental environment, but she's very skeptical of sort of the politics surrounding environmentalism and skeptical of any tendency in science or in environmentalism that tends to denigrate the human, the dignity of human life. She thinks that it's perfectly possible to be a good environmentalist and also believe that human beings are special. Like those are not incompatible ambitions or tenets. But I think her love of landscape speaks for itself. I mean, it's really remarkable.
Yeah. Well, we're nearing the end, but there's a couple of final questions I have. If anybody has any other thoughts or comments they want to make as we're getting near to rounding down here, Dr. Hanley, I did want to ask you about, you know, we have this entire epistolatory novel, but we talked online a little bit about what John Ames is doing here. Is this his final sermon? Is this what is this when we come to the end? What has he written for his son and for us?
Well, I think he tells us right at the very beginning. You know he sort of announces his purpose, and you know that this is your essential. I mean, we're kind of in the position of the child reading the book, right? This is as if he's already gone. And I find that so deeply moving, right? That this is a voice that he has himself imagined, right? Think about this. As he's writing it, he's imagining his own death, right? He's writing as if he were dead and looking back on his life. And so that's the sort of prayer of his prose, right? That's the aspirational faith of his prose, is that there's something lasting about this language that he can leave behind that would allow his son and him to commune and to have understanding of one, at least he could pass on the legacy of his own witness of his conscious experience. This has something, it's probably not enough time to go into this, but this has something to do, I think, with his fascinating idea that God, our relationship to God is really an aesthetic experience. There's something about the ability to imagine yourself dead, which is again a fiction that enables the richness of his life to become visible to him, and the sort of everything comes afire, right, as a result, and everything feels weighted with significance and sacredness, and that's sort of the power of his prose. So I find it so deeply moving because I keep thinking, well, he is essentially dead, right? I mean, he's about to die, but the fact that I'm reading it means he's dead. That's kind of what I love about the potency of his language. And I don't know if you've had that experience, if you lose a loved one. I lost a brother many years ago, and he had written me a letter on my 16th birthday, you know, and it was suddenly just weighted with significance that I had this one letter that he wrote me, that every word was suddenly like a feast, right? That I was savoring every searching for every possible significance in it. I think that's when, for her language, that's when we read, that's how we should read poetry. It's how we should read great literature. It's certainly how religious people believe they should be reading scripture. That sense that something transformative is about to happen is the act of imagination that allows it to happen. So it's a perfect setup for a really powerful voice, I think. And again, when you know that little context of Eames actually kind of sort of speaking to her, and I, you know, lots of novelists will describe that similar kind of experience. They hear, you know, sort of the voice of a character, and that kind of guides them. It's as if the fiction writes itself, right? That there's nothing deliberate about it or strategizing about it, at least in great fiction, right? You can read a lot of bad novels and it feels like, yeah, they're jerking my chain here and there. But when it feels like a real life, right? That's the fact that a human brain can imagine a real life that didn't ever exist is pretty amazing.
I think when you, throughout the book, John Eames will talk about how writing is a form of prayer for him. And thinking about Marilynne Robinson, hearing his voice come to her, and it shows where she places writing in her own spiritual practice.
Yeah, and I think just on that last question you asked about, I mean, for me, I think reading novels, I think it has a spiritual or religious dimension too, but I would say maybe most importantly, it's a moral exercise. You know, I just find it so important to cultivate, you know, compassionate imagination, just to be able to understand, even if they're not real people, what it's like to be other people. It's such a sad failure for us as human beings to not take advantage of that unique capacity that we have to imagine other people's lives in compassionate ways. And I think novels are tremendously effective at doing that when they're written well.
Well, and it's not, you know, the characters themselves aren't real, but the people who are writing them are, and imbuing those characters full of life and thought and ideas that are sometimes the writer's own, sometimes not, but a way to, you know, again, get inside the shoes of someone else and walk around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment.
Yeah.
Does she have any history in her family of working with the Underground Railroad? She kind of alludes to that a lot in her writing of this book.
Yeah, I don't think it's in her family that I'm aware of, but in her research on the history of the Midwest, and a lot of the religious colleges that were founded there and the religious movements that it's known for, that is the history that she feels is lost on a lot of contemporary American audiences, that we don't have an appreciation of that particular struggle and the ways in which religion informed that struggle. So mm-hmm. I know that's in the background of her research. I just don't have any awareness that that's in her own family line.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a fascinating little sub history that sort of weaves in and out of the book from time to time, particularly with the grandfather. Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of those books that I think for those of us who are relatively new to Robinson or brand new to Robinson, or even maybe have read some of her works before, it's, you just want more, you know. It does have that that thoughtful quality that you think, you know, for one thing, I kind of want to go back and read it again.
Yeah. Well, and if you liked it, I can't recommend enough the other novels. I'm super eager to jump into Jack now, but you mentioned earlier her books of essays. The Death of Adam is a fantastic book. When I was a child, I read books, is also absolutely terrific. The Givenness of Things, those are probably my three favorite of her collections of essays. And I don't know, I know it's a little, some people are so attached to Gilead that this is blasphemous. And I thought I was one of them. I think Gilead's one of the finest novels I've ever read. But Lila may have passed it. It's just such an extraordinary book, and who knows what I'll think of Jack. But and it's hard to pick, because when I go back and I remember what kind of an impact Housekeeping has had on my life and how many times I've returned to that book, it's so extraordinarily beautiful. So she just is really a writer to just explore in and explore widely, and you won't be disappointed.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hanley. We really appreciate you being here.
You bet. It was a lot of fun. And any chance to talk about Marilynne Robinson, is it? That's good. That's time well spent.
Dr. George Hanley, he's a professor of humanities at Brigham Young University. Our executive producer, Christy Miners, led the discussion. We were talking about Marilynne Robinson's novel, Gilead. Starting next month, in November, we're going to be reading Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. If you're interested in becoming a member of the Radio West Book Club, you can find details on our website, radiowest.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Doug Fabrizio.